You are listening to The Overwhelmed Brain. Today's episode is brought to you by GetOutOfTheMess.com. Quality attorneys at established law firms for about, $20 a month.
Those prices are insane!
Are you annoyed by affirmations? Are you tired of that same old, rehashed personal growth advice that all seems to boil down to, think positively and all your problems will go away? If affirmations feel like lies and positive thinking feels like denial, then I want you to get ready. The Overwhelmed Brain is here to help you create the life you want now. Hello, and welcome to The Overwhelmed Brain. I am your host, personal empowerment coach, Paul Coliani. I am here to help you increase your emotional intelligence, strengthen your self-worth and self-esteem, and empower you so that you can make decisions that are right for you. Everything I talk about on this show is my personal opinion and is meant for informational and educational purposes only. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your medical treatment. I'm going to read you an email right off the bat, and it's from someone who's experienced something that a lot of us have experienced, the fight, flight, or even freeze of life. You know what happens when something triggers you and you go into fight mode? You want to fight back, you want to be defensive and offensive and aggressive, or you go into flight mode, which is, I got to get out of here. I'm going to like step back and stay away. It's too dangerous. And then there's freeze mode. Freeze is when you are the deer in the headlights. And my girlfriend actually goes through this. She freezes if there's something that is, overpowering her brain or her senses. She gets to that point where she can't move. And I've seen this with abuse victims, physical and sexual abuse victims, where when they were children, they were held down against their will. It's not pleasant to talk about, but this is what happens sometimes. And because they were held down and they could do nothing, they did nothing. They couldn't do anything. They were stuck. And so that developed a behavior in them. And this is one way to get to freeze. But some of the people I know, some of the people I've met, go into freeze mode because of something like that. Again, not the only reason, but that kind of shows you how freeze could happen. It's developed in childhood, and if they feel like that's their only response, then that becomes a response when they grow up. So here's the email I'm going to read to you about this situation, and let's see where we go. Greetings. I've been listening for over a year now. This is in reference to your show about blaming others for everything. That was a while back, but it's in kind of its own category. I fully accept responsibility for times I've gotten angry and unreasonable with people, as there have been many, but there's a specific devastating affect that until 3 years ago followed me through my life. I'm in my 30s now. From my teenage years up until a few years ago, there was something that was happening to me that seemed unexplainable, that steered particularly important moments in my life away from a desirable direction and important moments of maturation. What would happen is I would experience the freeze portion of fight, flight, or freeze. Upon deciding to take action, I would experience absolute brain fog, and I couldn't recognize it, its onset until I was frozen in it. While in it, I could only think to give my body basic physical directions or become angry and hyper-focused at myself for being in this state while repeating, "Come on, damn it, why can't you just X, Y, or Z?" Any detailed thought was impossible. This experience kind of felt like the concussion I got a few years back. I imagine that's probably what it's like if you're an Alzheimer's sufferer. I went through this sort of tunnel thought perception, but my vision seemed fine. I noticed my freezing began with girls, which was kind of devastating. This is where it happened the most, and where I took notice of it as a consistent phenomenon. Looking back, I realized this did not start when girls said no to me. It started on the third or fourth time when one said yes. I actually took a dangerous amount of supplements to try and force my way past the freezing once. This didn't work out so well, and I drove home bawling while violently punching parts of my car's interior. This is when I decided it was impossible for me to approach women. I began referring to these as invisible walls and formed the belief that I was inherently made incorrectly, one of God's mistakes. This happened in my career, too. I also froze after going through personal training classes, and I had to make phone calls to get an internship, and I froze when I tried to make phone calls for setting up gigs for my band. So I avoided any topic or situation involving me approaching women, and I didn't do anything for my career. After I quit my band, I moved and I was without any friends for a while. I slowly fell into depression and increased marijuana use past a recreational amount. I accessed Dr. Internet, read about possible causes of depression, and I found that friendships were important to happiness. So, without going into it too much, this is where I now began freezing before getting invited out with my old friends, something that had never happened before. Thus began social anxiety. I also froze before attempting to go to a comedy open mic, just to watch. I'm an aspiring comedian. This freezing seemed to be in a very harmless and safe area, so it didn't make sense that I would freeze here. That was the last straw. Up until this point, I wasn't a victim blaming others, but I relentlessly blamed myself and assumed something was wrong with me. With the help of your podcast and a couple other shows, I gained awareness to look into my childhood. This led me into the correct hypothesis of me having a subconscious belief that I deserve punishment, which is apparently common, that formed in childhood. I looked at the times I froze and I thought, if I deserve punishment, then I also don't deserve reward. And from there, a coherent narrative was formed. I learned about treating PTSD with a regressive therapy technique. I ignored the re-traumatizing danger warning and spent a month treating the same two memories of my dad abusing me. I then went out to test to see if it worked by going on stage to actually do stand-up. Before trying this, I was in a negative, who cares space. I figured I'd still be in the same boat if this therapy didn't work. I went on stage, felt normal fear, and did stand-up. The week after, I cold approached a number of women. The freezing was gone. So, I actually decided I was a victim the moment I stopped feeling like one. Am now quite furious at my dad, who has been a therapist himself throughout all of this. Am I wrong to feel that way? And how should I approach repairing things with my father, who has always dismissed me? All right, I'm going to call you Joe. Let me make sure that's not your real name. Where are you? Right here. Okay, Joe, I'm going to say thank you, first of all, for sharing all of this. I'm happy that you found your way out of that state of freezing. And you said something very key, which was the abuse in your childhood. And that is something I started off this segment with, that often happens because of abuse. It's not the only reason, but absolutely. If you felt abuse in childhood and you felt like there was nothing you can do, that turns into a belief system. That turns into a perception of the world. And you take that perception in almost every circumstance. You generalize every situation to be very similar or the same as you felt when you were a kid. So it's almost like you said, PTSD. You are re-experiencing or becoming re-traumatized in events and situations causing you to behave the same way. Yet this time, there's no one holding you down. It's just yourself. And you came up with some very important words about yourself. I deserve punishment. I also don't deserve reward. And you realized there was a narrative there that you were playing, a script that was running your life. And I think that's an important point for anyone listening, is that sometimes there is a script that runs and the same words are spoken or the same thoughts are occur when you are being re-traumatized, when there's a PTSD event, when you're being re-triggered. And that script is followed to a T. And you do go through the same motions. So you are a victim of your childhood. You're a victim of the dysfunction and the abuse and whatever occurred back there. We're all sort of victims like that. We come out of childhood learning about the world through the conditions that we're in. And if those conditions aren't healthy, we have an unhealthy perspective of the world. If we have certain events in our life that cause us to go into fight or flight or freeze, we can look at that and go, something from my past is occurring here. Because what's happening now probably isn't something I need to fight or flee or freeze about. There's just something that I'm holding on to that I need to look at. And some people don't want to look at it. They just see the situation as dangerous or harmful in some way, so they get out of it. Whereas you were getting sick of it. You were finally able to find something, what you called regressive therapy, and utilize that on yourself. And that can be a scary thing to do. Like you said, you ignored the re-traumatizing danger. And that's what I do too. I'm not saying everyone should do that. Always go to a professional and talk to them about it. But I like visiting the abuse moments in my past. Not that I like it, but I know that visiting it is very powerful. And there's one thing that I teach on this show every now and then, which is, it's called something I learned in NLP called perceptual positions. And what that means is that when you imagine something in your past, something that traumatized you, something that really affected you negatively, there are several ways to not only look at it, but to also remember it. Because what happens is that we remember things exactly the same way over and over again. And if there are any negative emotions attached to those memories, then guess what we're doing? We're remembering it the same way and we're feeling the same way about it every single time. So not only do we remember it the same way we remembered it before, but we're reinforcing and sometimes even amplifying the memory and the feeling that comes with it. For example, remembering someone dying in your life. If you remembered that event, the moment you found out and how awfully you felt, if you remember that over and over and over again, you're eventually going to set it in stone. And that's what happens. That reinforcing sets it in stone and creates like a groove in a record. So every time you put the needle in that groove, it plays the same memory, plays the same music over and over again. And that's not pleasant if it's a negative memory. With positive memories, that's great. That's fine. You know, anything that makes you feel good, anything that makes you feel happy, if you're remembering it that way, perfect. If it doesn't bother you, great. But with negative memories, like I said, I teach something called perceptual positions, which is when you remember the event and then you see the event not from your own eyes, but from another location in the room. Or you see the event from the ceiling. Or how about this one? You see the event from the eyes of someone else in the room. You may not want to do that, but that is another way to perceive the situation. And because what happens is when you start perceiving it from outside yourself, from different locations in the room, it makes you think of it differently. And not only that, it helps scratch the record a little bit. It helps ungroove, you know, get you out of the rut of that reinforcing negativity. And I really like that idea. When you have something negative that keeps replaying, then what would happen if I remembered it while sitting in a movie theater watching it on a screen? Look how far removed you are from that memory, watching yourself up on that screen. Or watching yourself from the back of the theater, watching yourself on the screen. It's called dissociation. When you dissociate far enough away from the thoughts and emotions and you're perceiving it from a distance. You're looking at it from afar. And that changes how you feel about it. I'm not saying this is a cure-all or anything. I'm just saying that it's one of the steps that I like to teach every now and then to help people feel less traumatized by it. So the record doesn't play the same song over and over and over again and make you feel bad. And that's an interesting little technique you can try on yourself with any memory. Not only that, not only perceptual positions, but also changing history. It's another little NLP trick, is that you can go back in time in your memory and add something to the memory or take away something from the memory. For example, you can picture the traumatic event with Michael Bolton playing in the background or circus music playing in the background. Not that I'm trying to diminish your experience or anything like that, but it just changes how you feel about it. It may make you hate circus music, but it does change something about the memory. You can darken the memory. You can brighten the memory. If it was inside, you can put it outside. You can change a lot of stuff about it. If you're in a small room, make it a big room. It's your brain. You can do anything you want. If there's a deep voice in the room, then make it into a high Mickey Mouse voice. If there's no one else around to protect you, then put a protector in there. I had one client that I worked with put a protector in the room while she was remembering the abuse, and that changed her life. I mean, it changed everything because that protector followed her through every memory. So whatever your protector is, hers wasn't even human. So this is something that you can also think of doing. There's one thing I did with my wife when I was married, when she was like really angry with me. There was something that I did in the grocery store, and I said I was having feelings about, and she got really upset, rightly so, because I was being emotionally abusive. I was triggered, and I was triggering her. And when we went home, she remembered that moment, and she was still angry. And I said, I was still learning some of this stuff and how it can help change the emotions on a with a memory. And I said, why don't you do this? Why don't you picture me with a donkey's head, talking in a donkey's voice, saying the same thing I said to you then? Boy, when she did that, she just started cracking up. And that made me feel better. At least she wasn't holding on to this anger toward me. Not that we didn't have something to work out, but at least it changed. It helped me understand that you can take a traumatic or upsetting memory of some sort and change it. And that was great. So I teach that too. It's like, okay, if you have someone that really annoys you, turn their head into a donkey or a pig or something that makes you laugh, a platypus, and add the strange voice. And it's not like you're changing what they said to you. You're just changing how they said it, how they looked when they said it, what they look like, with their face, what animal they are or what creature they are or what cartoon character they are. I don't know. You just play with it. And there's all kinds of things you can do to your memories so that they're not continually reinforced in a negative way, because they're your memories. It's like the box of pictures I had. I had 600 pictures, the real photographs, not the digital ones. And I was going through the box, and some of them made me feel not so good. And I thought, why am I keeping pictures that don't make me feel good? Why don't I just get rid of them? And I did. I threw them away, and I felt better because I knew I would never have to look at those pictures again. So that's how I see your mind, is like it's a box of pictures. And you know what? If you don't like it, yeah, sure, it'd be nice to throw it away. The mind doesn't really do that easily. So let's change it. Because I guarantee when you add these new elements or subtract new elements, you're going to find that the memory does change. The emotions around the memories change. And maybe you'll become less sensitive to them. So that's just an idea, a thought you can play with, see where it goes. But let me go back to Joe's question and the idea of freezing in the fight, flight, or freeze state. Freezing, he said something important, which was, when I'm frozen, I can barely give myself direction to move. I just feel frozen. And I think one of the most important steps you can take for yourself if you go into freeze mode is to think ahead before the freeze. And what I mean by that is think about times in your life that you froze, and then think of that time happening again. For example, if you approach someone that you want to date and you want to ask them to roller skate, I'm thinking back to my youth. And let's just say that's a good example. That's a good example. Let me go back there and remember a time when I wanted to roller skate with a girl, but I was afraid to ask. And my dad's like, just go over there and ask. What's the problem? And I'd be like, no. I don't want to face that. If I think about that now, what would I do now if I was single and I wanted to ask someone, for coffee or out on a date? How would I feel? I'll go through it in my imagination, and then I'll see what comes up for me. I'll go through each step, And then I'll get right up to her and I'll go, hey, you want to grab coffee sometime? What kind of thoughts come up for me in that moment? What if she says no? If she says no, how do I handle it then? Okay, that's cool, that's cool. Or how will I feel? Will I suddenly feel like a complete moron? Will I feel like an idiot? Will I feel this massive rejection and feel awful and then walk away feeling awful and carry it with me? I'm going through all these thoughts as I imagine the scenario unfolding. And this is good to think about. Okay, what happens to me? Because what I want you to do is think of the very first negative thing that comes to mind. So you're across the room. I mean, think of your own scenario if this doesn't work for you. But using this example, I'm across the room and I see someone I might want to roller skate with or take out or take to coffee or whatever. The first thing that might come to my mind is, why would she want to go out with me? That might be my first thought. Another thought is, she probably has someone already. You know, I'm thinking about this in real time. She's probably into better looking men. She's probably into men that are more physically fit. I have all these insecurities popping up in me. Now, are there any emotions that come up for me? Like the very first thing I said is, why would she want to go out with me? I think it's important to explore that. Why would she want to go out with me? Why would I even ask that question? Well, why wouldn't she want to go out with me? Let's turn it around. Well, she might not want to go out with me because X, Y, and Z. Sure. But why would she want to go out with me? That's a good question. Okay, why did I ask that question? And then I'll explore that. Well, I probably asked that question of myself because I think that I'm not good enough. Okay, so that might touch on some self-worth stuff. Okay, why do I think, this is where we drill down, right? Why do I think that I'm not worthy enough for someone to go out with me? This is kind of along the lines where Joe was going. Like, I deserve punishment. Like, where is that coming from? And this is good to understand, because whatever you're carrying around, whatever nervousness or insecurity that you have in yourself that prevents you from doing things that you want to do, almost always from some major or minor traumatic event in childhood, or if not childhood, somewhere in your youth where you learned how to fear. When did you learn how to fear? It's not necessarily about asking someone out. It's all the thoughts and feelings and emotions that you're having way before it happens. That's why it's important to, as you go through these steps, what is the first negative thought or feeling or emotion that you have? And then latch onto that and analyze that in yourself and ask yourself, where does that come from? And another good question is, when was the first time I felt that? And you just have to explore each scenario and find out what's preventing you from moving forward. Because the reason I'm telling you to go in that direction is because the buildup from the very first negative feeling that you get, it builds up and amplifies until you get to the moment of truth where you may freeze. And imagine if you're able to conquer the first step. Like, oh, geez, I feel low self-worth because my mom said this to me and I carried that with me through my whole life. I may need to visit that memory or one before it where I felt the same way if I can find one. I'm always a fan of going back to the very first time you felt something and exploring that in the same way I was just talking about revisiting a memory, changing the memory. That stops the first domino from knocking down the rest of the dominoes. I know I'm simplifying, I know there's more to this, but it gives you something to work on when it comes to anything that you jump into subconsciously. Because that's what happens. You go unconscious when you're freezing, or even your fight or flight state is an unconscious state that you get into where it feels like you've lost a little bit of control. Like you've pushed me over the edge and now I'm going to start throwing punches. That can be a very unconscious state where you can't stop until the danger is over, or you've eliminated the danger, or you've run away from the danger, or whatever it is. All important stuff to explore way before it happens. What is the first thought or feeling or emotion that you have? And explore that. Trace it back to something in your past. Now, with Joe's question, I'm finally getting to it. Am I wrong to feel the way I feel? How should I approach repairing things with my father, who has always dismissed me? He says he's quite furious with his dad, who's been a therapist throughout this whole thing. First of all, you're not wrong to feel anyway. If you are mad at your dad, that's perfectly legit. You can be mad at anyone you want. You can hate anyone you want. You are furious at your father. You are absolutely in the right to be furious at your father. I'm not saying you're right and he's wrong or anything like that. I'm saying that you are allowed to feel that emotion. You're allowed to feel it. So absolutely let it roll inside you, because you have every right to feel anything you want to feel. Your next question, how should I approach repairing things with my father who has always dismissed me? Well, A, do you get along with your father otherwise? Do you want to repair your relationship with him? Do you have to repair your relationship with him? Someone who's always dismissed you? I'm just asking, because if any of those answers are no, then why are you pursuing it? If your answer is, well, I must have a father, I would answer with, do you want a father who always makes you feel bad? I'm not saying that this is my answer. I'm just posing questions to help you come to a conclusion in your mind and come to clarity with what direction you want to go with this. So the first question is, do you want a relationship with your father? And if the answer is yes, do you want the kind of relationship that you've had? Probably not. If he has always dismissed you, does that mean he's never validated you, made you feel loved, made you feel important, made you feel like his son, someone he loves? Because if that's not in there, it may not come out. Now, along this path of helping you come to a conclusion, there are people that are proud to change who they are. And if they change who they are, they might become vulnerable. And if they're vulnerable, they'll feel the pain that they've been holding back, whatever that is. So I don't know what your father's background or history is, but if your father has been holding on to something painful and he doesn't want to address it, and because he doesn't address it, love doesn't spew from his pores, then you may have been experiencing his level of functionality in the world. You may have been experiencing his capability, his capacity. That doesn't mean he doesn't have potential. It just means up to this point, he may not have been able to be there for you because of what he's going through, which is, you know, almost always the case, of course. Whatever your parents are going through, it gets passed on in some functional or dysfunctional way to you, and now you have to figure out how to deal with their dysfunction or their mental challenges or whatever you want to call it. So if he has been this way up to this point, how do you repair or approach repairing things? I think your focus shouldn't be on repairing. I think your focus needs to be on stating your case. And what I mean by that is, it's the same way I look at apologizing. When you apologize, you say it, you mean it with all your heart, and then you leave the ball in their court. I feel so bad. I am sorry. And I hope someday you can see past this and see that I am willing to go forward with this relationship, but I just want to let you know I am sorry. When you apologize to someone and you mean it, you should never have to apologize again, because you said it, it came from the heart, and you meant it, and that's it. Now it's in their court. Now they may come back and say, I'm so mad at you, I can't believe you did it. And you can go, you're right, I'm so sorry, and apologize while you're still in that same conversation or while they're venting. But I do believe that once you apologize, that if they continue to say, well, I'm still mad at you, you can say, I understand. But inside you're going, well, I'm not apologizing again because I meant it the first time. Even if they say, well, you should apologize over and over again, you can actually say, I'm not going to apologize again because I meant it. And I understand if you are still angry, and I'll leave you alone. And then you walk away. I'm not saying it's like word for word like that. I'm just saying that apologies, when meant, only have to be said once. So this is my approach with you, with your father, is that you state your case and you ask questions. You can state your case by asking questions. Like, Dad, you knew I was going through this. How come you didn't help me? You find out what's going on. And stating your case is basically saying, look, this is where I was this whole time. And I'm pretty upset. I'm mad as hell. And I feel like you weren't there for me. You state that. Now, you may get a defensive response. You may get a number of responses. Or you may get, I never knew you felt that way. I don't know, but this is where you define your relationship from this point forward, because you might want to know where you stand in his eyes. Now, approaching him aggressively might cause him to be defensive. So that's why I like asking questions. Like, did you know I was going through such hard times? Did you know that I felt like I couldn't do anything? I was freezing all the time? And if he says, no, I didn't know that, then that's a different conversation. You can even say, you know, I thought you knew and I was so mad because you knew. But if he says, well, yes, but, you know, that's not my problem. That's your life. I'm living my life. You know, some dismissive comment like he does, then you can again state your case. You can say, that really upset me. I cannot believe that you don't care enough about me to want me to feel better, to be better, your own son. I mean, that might be a tough thing to say. That might be a tough conversation to have. It might be hurtful to him. It might be hard for you to say. I'm not saying you have to do this, but I do recommend that if you want closure and you want to find out if this relationship is salvageable, you ask questions, you state your case, and he may not like it. He may not comply. Or if he really is dismissive and is incapable of giving you the love and support you need, you may need to cut ties. I don't want you to have to choose, but you really need to know. How do you find out how someone feels about you? You kind of have to put them on the spot. But I do recommend not approaching it with anger. Approach him with curiosity. Curiosity is great. You know, my girlfriend said that she was upset at her father for something he didn't even do. she's like, I'm so upset with him. And she was sharing this with me a while back. And I was like, wait. So what did your father say about this? And she goes, well, I haven't talked to him yet. I was like, you might want to talk to him and ask him if what you're saying is true. Yes, but I, you know, that's something he would say. And I was like, well, why don't you ask him? And so she did. She finally ended up asking, you know, calmly. She didn't get angry. She just asked, you know, did you, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, what? Why would I do that? And suddenly it was a different conversation. And all this anger that she held on to was not applicable. So I'm not saying it's going to happen in your case, because you said your dad's always dismissed you. And so that may be who he is from this point on. But, you know, if you ask questions and you're not getting the answers that might lead to a healthy, nurturing, and supportive relationship, and you again feel dismissed, you know, say your final words. Say, you know what, I really want to have a nice, loving father-son relationship with you, but you refuse to go there. Again, you don't have to repeat my words. I'm just putting myself in your position. And if my father is incapable of going there, then I need to kind of wean myself off of him, wean myself away. Even though I might want a father figure in my life, but if it's a father figure that continues to poison the milk, then I have to get away, because it's going to poison me and cause me to deteriorate over time. It'll hurt. It'll hurt being with him more than it will be without him. And I'll have to seek some other sort of male or masculine role model in my life. So I don't know if this helps you, Joe. This is a tough one. I don't know what kind of conversation you can have with him. I think being furious and yelling at him is probably not the best approach. But if you can approach him inquisitively with curiosity and just give him some safe place to communicate with you, because he may never have had that himself, even though, you know, you can see a lot of things about him that you don't like, you got to remember that he'd probably been suffering for a long time, because it's natural for a dad to love their child. So it's unnatural for them to dismiss you, which means it's probably, the love is probably in there, but he's not ever been able to express it or has repressed some sort of emotions in his childhood that caused him to be the way he is today. That might give him a little leniency as you talk with him, but it may not be enough to repair many, many years of dismissing and invalidating or whatever was going on with you. I hope this helps, Joe. Good luck. Send me an update sometime. We'll be right back. Hey, when you get a second, go to getoutofthemess.com and check out one of the testimonial videos for Legal Shield. And you're going to see something that I love to see in people's faces, which is relief. It's relief that they have someone to call, that they have a place to go and a resource to use whenever they need to, whenever they feel like they're backed into a corner. Or if they're not being listened to by an individual or a company, there's someone that you can call and get advice. And getoutofthemess.com connects you with that service. Asha is an independent associate for Legal Shield, and she can answer your questions to find out if this service would be good for your situation. So I highly recommend it. I use it. She's been using it for years and years. And I hear story after story of the people that call her. I mean, there's all kinds of things. There's a lot of divorces going on, unfortunately. But fortunately, too, because you might have to get away from someone that just doesn't suit you anymore or is being harmful in some way or is a problem in another way. And you want some advice. And it's nice to have this legal advice line instead of, I don't know, paying an attorney $250 an hour. You can pay for this service for about $20 a month. And you can make all the calls you want. They just have like a ticketing system. So you call them up and they create a ticket for you. And then you work off that ticket for that particular issue. And it's all included with that monthly subscription. It's really, really cool. So check it out. Go to getoutofthemess.com or call 678-355-8777. And Asha will answer the phone and let you know if this service is right for you. All right, I want to talk about something that has happened a couple times in the past couple days. I'm hearing from people that are breaking up. And we just heard that Get Out of the Mess ad, right? Breaking up is part of life, it seems. But I don't know if you've ever been through a divorce or a breakup and you feel pain. You feel hurt. You feel lost. You feel confused. You don't know what to do next. You aren't sure if you can trust your decisions. That sometimes happens. Like, I decided to be with this person. How do I trust myself to pick the next right person? Or on and on. I mean, there's a lot of things that you go through. And I look at the end of a relationship as the death of a part of your heart. It sounds awful to say, but it's true. I mean, I can say this from experience. I've experienced it many times in my life. I like to think of myself as I don't know. I think my girlfriend called me this, a serial monogamist. And I don't know if that's a good thing. I think it is. And I think she means is that I like to stay in a relationship as long as I can, or at least this is my perspective. I like to stay with the same person as long as I can until apparently they get sick of me. Or at least that's how it's been. Now, from every breakup I've had, I had a lot of lessons from those breakups, and I've taken those lessons, as we all should, into our next relationship, if we have another relationship. Sometimes that doesn't happen right away, sometimes it does, but I think it's very important to look at the last relationship and understand not necessarily what happened, because you can't always figure that out. So it's not necessarily looking at the last relationship going, what happened? Why did this person break up with me? Or why did I do the things I did? Or whatever. Because sometimes you won't be able to answer that. Because sometimes they'll break up and you'll think, I saw no signs at all. They broke up with me and I saw no sign whatsoever. How could I have possibly known to do anything different? So I don't think it's a matter of looking back and asking what happened, because that may be an unanswerable question. I think it's a matter of looking back and going, okay, what could I do differently so that it doesn't happen again? That helps you take responsibility for your role in the breakup or whatever happened in the relationship, in any possible dysfunction or unhealthy behavior, or even what you consider healthy behavior and how it transformed into something that you didn't appreciate in the end, like a breakup. Hard to explain, but I think you understand, is that you look at what you did in the relationship and what can I do differently? And how about how you gave yourself in the relationship? How did I give myself to my partner in the relationship? Was it completely freely and vulnerable and they can have all of me? Or was I limited or restricting? Was I giving enough love? Was I giving, I hate to say, too much love? I mean, what if I was too clingy the whole time? What did they complain about? What did they give me dirty looks about? This is all about taking responsibility for your role in what happened, even if the things they did caused the breakup or caused the relationship to malfunction, if you want to call it that. When the relationship ended, they could have been responsible for everything that led up to the breakup and led up to them leaving and led up to the heartache and the heartbreak and all the bad stuff in between. But it's still important to look in yourself, even if you weren't responsible for anything, even if you gave the right amount of love, the perfect balance of everything that someone else would love to have in a relationship. And just look at yourself and go, okay, what didn't I see happening? What didn't I witness? What didn't I, what was I blind to then? Because this is what happens after the breakup. You look back and go, wait a minute. I remember this moment in time when he or she said this, and I thought it meant something else. Or I remember when they did this, and I didn't think anything of it. Or I had a suspicion about that, or I had a fear about that, but I didn't do anything about it. I tell you what, almost always you can look back in a relationship and see the signs in hindsight, of course. But that's what I'm talking about with lessons. Because I've heard from people that their partner broke up or wanted a divorce and they were blindsided. Like, what? Where did this come from? Or even worse, they were betrayed in some way. They were cheated on. They were ridiculed. They were humiliated, embarrassed. All these other things that could have happened in the relationship. They were manipulated, emotionally abused, physically abused. All these other things that can happen that are more obvious, at least the physical abuse is more obvious. But looking back, you can see the signs. And so you go, okay, yes, they did XYZ, but what did I do? What? Oh, here's a good question, and I don't mean any offense. How did I fail to see this then? How did I fail to see what was happening? Because if you can really pinpoint how you failed, you've got some great knowledge and wisdom to bring with you into your future relationships. Imagine knowing exactly what you did or didn't do before and being aware of it next time. I mean, when I talk about this, it sounds like common sense, right? well, this led to this, led to this, and obviously I'll look for that next time. But a lot of the times, and I've talked to a lot of people that have gone through breakups, separations, or divorces, and they are still in the blindsided state. They are still, I don't know what happened. I can't figure it out. And they stay there almost as if they're in a state of shock, and they're frozen. It's like that letter I read, fight, flight, or freeze. They were frozen in this state of shock, and they can't get past that their partner did XYZ, or their partner broke up and there was absolutely no reason for the breakup. I'm not saying that you can absolutely find the signs or the symptoms when you look back in hindsight, but I bet you 99% of the people can. I know that I can. I mean, when my first long-term girlfriend broke up with me, it was after 2 years of almost no contact. I mean, no physical contact. We lived together. We talked to each other. We did all the same things, and nothing else seemed different except the bedroom. So our lives were perfect otherwise, but, you know, I always attribute it to she was sick or her knee hurt or something else. 2 years, I just lived in denial, I guess, or I just didn't know enough to understand what was really happening. I was a young guy. I didn't have too much relationship experience before then. So for me, the last 2 years of that relationship, I started getting depressed, and I did have thoughts and feelings about having no physical contact in the bedroom, but it wasn't, it was weird. It wasn't like I felt like the relationship was ending. I thought it was a phase. So after I got through that relationship and got into my marriage, and I was starting to heal from the past because I brought some pain into my marriage, which is a bad idea, but it happened. And my wife at the time really helped me through a lot of that stuff, so I was grateful for that. But I looked back at that relationship, and I go, wait a minute. I remember the very first signs of the degradation of our relationship, when it started to dissolve. But I didn't do anything about it. I didn't mention it. I didn't think of it as a red flag, but I can look at those very first signs and understand myself and what I did and didn't do so it would continue. And that's key right there. What didn't I do, or what did I do to allow whatever it was to continue? When I look back, I know what I did or didn't do. Mostly, I didn't say anything. I didn't say, hey, it's been 2 weeks. We are normally intimate within 2 weeks. I wonder what's happening. I didn't say that to my, well, I said that to myself, but I didn't really convey it or express it to her. And so 2 weeks turned into a month, turned into 6 months, turned into a year. And then maybe it happened once, and then suddenly I'm placated for another year. But it's the same thing. After 2 weeks after that moment, it was, oh, I wonder why it didn't happen again. And back then, I was afraid to say anything. If I said anything, you know, maybe she'll get mad at me. Maybe she'll leave me. So I look back at that kind of behavior and go, so who I was, this fearful person, afraid to say things because of a fear of the consequences, wasn't working. And that's vital to know for you, to take with you into your future with any relationship, is what did I do that wasn't working? How can I, and this is the hard part, how can I change how I behaved then so that that doesn't happen again? My biggest fear in changing my behavior, because I knew what it was. My behavior was I wasn't expressing my truth. I wasn't being authentic. I hid behind my fear and I chose not to say anything because maybe there really was a breakup impending doom here. So I didn't want to face it, so I kept it repressed so it wouldn't come up and become a reality. But the truth is, what's repressed is just delaying the inevitable and even makes it worse. Because all that time I kept repressing and repressing, and as you probably heard me say, unless you're a first-time listener, When you suppress your thoughts and you repress your emotions, you will end up in depression. I've seen this over and over again. If I choose not to say what's on my mind and I hold back the emotions I'm feeling, then where does it go? It stays inside of me. It gets stuffed down. And pretty soon, there's no more room for any repressed emotions. And then you feel the effects of emotional Novocaine, where you just start numbing out. And you start becoming dead to the world. It feels like you've lost your passion. You don't feel any zest for life. And all you want to do is just stay home and do nothing, or something worse. You know, you want to hurt yourself or kill yourself. And I've had all of the above. I've had all of those thoughts because I chose not to speak up when I sensed something was not right. Or I felt in some way fearful or hurt. I mean, there are times when she disrespected me or invalidated me that I didn't say anything. But those are so important to take with me in my life. Anytime you can think of someone doing something to you where you felt like you could have or wanted to say something or do something differently, that's what you do differently. And I know it's hard as hell. It is really hard if you've not done what you needed to do then or should have done then. You know, I use that term loosely, should have done, because maybe the end of the relationship was a good thing. I look at these relationships as very good lessons for me that led me to down a better road and up very healthy stepping stones for my life. And had they not ended, I wouldn't have learned. I wouldn't have moved on. So I'm very fortunate to look back and see the pain I went through and even the depression and all the breakups, these women that left me, because all of that revealed a lot about myself. I mean, I learned that I was emotionally abusive. That would never have happened if someone didn't leave me. It was a gift, and I am grateful for it, even though I don't want to experience it again because it's too painful and I just don't want another lesson. But if it happens again, then I needed to learn it. I needed for it to happen so that I don't create another bad relationship, so that I don't show up as a bad partner. Bad meaning unhealthy, bad meaning dysfunctional. I want to show up for my partner as healthy as I can possibly be. That's who I want to be for them. And when I can bring the best version of myself into the relationship, and they hopefully bring the best version of themselves into the relationship, then you have synergy. Then you have, you're going in the same direction, holding hands. I think that's a nice picture. But it does take a lot of pain in life sometimes to get to that healing, to get to that learning and growing, so that there is an evolution, so that there is progression instead of regression. I think that's vital. We'll be right back to close the show and give you my final words on this very topic after this. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Overwhelmed Brain. I want to thank you if you've purchased a book or workbook on the website, theoverwhelmedbrain.com, or if you're a member of the patron program at the patron.theoverwhelmedbrain.com, where you can support the site, you can support what we do over here, and also get private episodes and workbooks and even email coaching. You can check that out at patron.theoverwhelmedbrain.com. And let me ask you a question. Are you in one of those complex relationships? You know the kind, the one where you feel like no matter what you do, you can't seem to please your partner? Well, I wrote an article on my blog that may or may not be what you're going through. Hopefully not. It's called, Are You Being Abused by a Narcissist? Check it out, theoverwhelmedbrain.com. You can read that article and it'll give you some information that you might find helpful if you feel at all a little crazy in your relationship. And of course, if you resonate with that article, I highly recommend getting the Mean Workbook, where you can learn if your relationship is experiencing manipulation or emotional abuse and just how enmeshed you are in it. The workbook reveals some pretty deep unspoken behavior, and it'll give you and your partner just what you need to talk about, which might be covert or even overt manipulation or emotional abuse. Of course, if your partner doesn't think there's anything wrong in the relationship, but you feel it every day, they don't think it's a problem, but you know there's a problem, maybe you just need to read this on your own. Visit theoverwhelmedbrain.com and you'll see a link to the Mean Workbook right on the front page and the article. And finally, whether you're in the patron program, whether you've purchased any of those things, you can also support the show by going to theoverwhelmedbrain.com and clicking on the Amazon link. The Amazon link is one of the easiest ways to give back. So if you're a regular listener, use that Amazon link every time you shop. It helps the show. You're really making a difference. So thank you. And finally, thank you to Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com for some of the music transitions in The Overwhelmed Brain. And to close the show, I talked about in the last segment what it feels like to break up. Not that I need to tell you this if you've ever gone through a breakup, because it's pretty damn painful. And or at least it can be, unless it's a celebration. Sometimes it can be a celebration, yes. But if you're in love and then you're not, or they break up or you break up, it's even hard for the person that wants to get out of the relationship because they might still love the person but can't be around them. I mean, you may not be able to be around the person you broke up with because they are harming you in some way. They are hurtful. It's painful. I like to look at it this way. If they don't make you feel good about yourself, that's something to look at. That's something to talk about. That's something to get help on if you want to pursue that. And if they don't seem to be supporting your path to happiness, that's something else to talk about. That's something else you might need to get help on if you're not getting that. And it works both ways. If you can help them make them feel good about themselves and you are supporting their path to happiness too, because it has to work both ways, both partners have to do it so that you can show up as your best self to each other, then it works splendidly. But if you're not doing that with your partner, or they're not doing it to you, or both, then I don't think it's going to work. I just don't see any way around that. So that's important. But one of the things I wanted to say regarding where it feels like there is a death of a part of your heart, where it feels like a part of your heart has died or a part of you has died when the breakup happens, that is what I see as part of your identity. It's part of the me and you equals us. When you go to a social gathering, they'll always say, "Hey, we're so-and-so. How are you and so-and-so?" And so you start to identify yourself as not just you, but you and that person. So that feels like a part of you, and it makes you feel even special because you're part of something bigger. But losing that feels like a part of you is lost. That's when your heart, or at least a part of it, feels empty because the other part is you. The part that's empty was us, was how you felt when you were together, was how you felt when you had good times, when you had intimacy, when things were all right. And then when things weren't all right, you might have some of that in your heart too. That's sometimes the stuff we keep, right? Things weren't all right. That's when he or she hurt me. Or that's when he or she said mean things or betrayed me. I'm still holding on to that. And so we have this empty piece, and then we have this hurt piece, and then we have that piece that is us. So it's all very important to understand that what we're carrying around and what we feel like we're missing, so that we know what we need to do. We need to heal the part that's hurting. But that may not happen until we nurture the part that's empty. Nurture, support, That is what psychology calls your inner child. And that inner child is just the younger part of you that feels scared, hurt, maybe sad, depressed, angry, everything that you don't like feeling. I mean, the inner child can also be happy and positive and all that too, but any extreme one way or another outside of the balance, I attribute to the younger part of ourselves that still goes into these emotional triggers, still is unsure what to do. I mean, especially about the negative stuff. When you feel this emotional pain because you've been triggered in some way, whether it's a breakup or a death, which feels like the same thing sometimes, then the inner child can kick in and the inner child can cry and be angry and be sad and be scared and feel unloved and unwanted. The inner child, that person inside of you, that young girl or young boy, can feel alone and scared. And I like to look at that as, if I saw a child that felt like that, what would I do for that child? What if that child was sitting alone on a bench and looked afraid? What if that child was crying? What would I do then? No one's around. What would I do? What would you do? And I like to think that I would walk up to that child and comfort in any way I possibly can. But I go one step further. I look at that child over there and go, hey, that child is me. I'm going to walk over and comfort that child and find out what that child wants. What do you want? What's wrong? Why are you so sad? What do you need right now? And I do that little exercise inside of me. And that really starts to connect with that pain in my heart. That's where there can be some healing. And that really starts to rebuild what feels empty inside. And as you rebuild that empty space, little, by reconnecting with that younger part of yourself, the healing can take place too, that the healing of that hurt part. It'll start being re-nurtured and revitalized, but reconnecting with that younger part of you to start filling any emptiness that you might feel by giving yourself the support that you really need in that moment. That's, to me, is the true definition of loving yourself. That, to me, is giving yourself what you feel is no longer there, what you feel you don't have access to anymore, what you feel is empty. You start to refill it little by little. It takes a while. I mean, if you're in the middle of the breakup and everything's happening at once and your system's in that state of shock and it doesn't know what to do and you're confused and you're having all these thoughts, there's a grieving period. I do believe there is a grieving period for your relationship because you need to figure out what to do with this sudden detachment of what you were so used to, of what you were so comfortable with. And that grieving is like grieving someone's death. You look at the relationship and you grieve the end of the relationship as if it were a person that died. Because what that does is you finally get to a place, it may take a while, but you finally get to a place of acceptance that this relationship is over so that you can move on, so that you can move forward, so that you're not so focused on what went wrong and moving forward so that you can refill the void. Forward momentum is what does that. It fills that empty space. It heals the heart. When you stay attached and you stay in hoping and wishing and praying that the person will come back to you, that's when you prolong the pain. I'm not saying it'll never happen, because you and them might get back together and everything might be great, and maybe you'll start anew, or maybe you won't. But either way, it's important that, you know, after a period of time, you come to that acceptance that it's over. And that's so hard for so many people. If it's over, if I accept that it's over, then that means I won't be available if they call. That means I won't be, maybe I'll be in another relationship when they want to get back together. But by staying in that hoping and wishing and praying state, you end up in that emotional rut that keeps you stagnant, that doesn't go anywhere, and that keeps your heart from healing. And the reason all this is so important is to accept and move on, is because let's just say that you did get back together someday, if that's what you both wanted. Wouldn't you want to get back together with a healed heart and more wisdom of what you did in the past and a fresh start so that nothing from the past was repeated? Because that's how you do it. That's how you move forward, is by accepting this relationship as gone, as a loss, and moving on. That might take a while. Like I said, it doesn't mean, you know, the day after the breakup, that's what you do. I think there's a mourning period. There has to be grieving. There has to be, well, it doesn't have to be, but there are stages of mourning where you get to a point where you can finally come to a place of acceptance and you're ready to move on. But that timeline is up to you. It just depends on when you're ready to heal. And as always, if you're not quite ready to heal, just keep an open mind so that you can step into your power. And soon you'll learn to be firm in your decisions and actions so that you can create the life you want. Always take steps to grow and evolve. You are powerful beyond measure. And above all, and this is something I absolutely know to be true about you, you are amazing. If you do make any changes and they're positive, well, you can blame me. I'm not going to keep that in.